Imagine waking up tomorrow morning, right? You check your mail, and there's this official government notice sitting there.
Never a good start to the day.
No, exactly. And this notice declares that you owe them $10,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know you don't owe this money. I mean, you have your tax records, you know what your income is, and, you know, without a doubt, there has been a massive mistake.
Right.
But when you try to call to sort it out, there's no caseworker. You log into the portal, and there's just no human logic to appeal to.
Just a machine.
Exactly. A machine simply averaged your income across the entire year. It flagged some like mathematical discrepancy in a specific 2-week window, categorized you as fraudulent, and just automatically issued the debt.
And suddenly you're on the hook.
You are. The burden of proof is now entirely on you.
Yeah.
And if you can't, you know, dig up payslips from 5 years ago, your wages are going to be garnished.
You know, it really sounds like some dystopian sci-fi thought experiment. But that exact scenario actually played out in reality for hundreds of thousands of people.
It's terrifying.
It is. It's the perfect, terrifying distillation of what happens when we just, well, surrender institutional authority to a machine without setting up the rules of engagement first.
And that brings us to why we're here. Today is August 30th, 2026, and we are plunging into this incredibly dense, newly published capstone paper.
It's quite a read.
It really is. It warns us that this kind of nightmare scenario isn't just a glitch. It's actually the default trajectory of an ungoverned AI ecosystem. The paper is called Artificial Intelligence and the Epistemic Commons, and it's by independent scholar and physician Dr. Bechara Saleh.
A really brilliant breakdown of the current crisis.
Absolutely. So our mission for this deep dive is to explore basically the ultimate clone of our era. And that is, how can a civilization think with artificial intelligence without being thought for by it?
That's the crux of it, really.
Okay, let's unpack this because we need a baseline before we get into the heavy stuff.
Right. Well, the baseline here isn't about being anti-tech or pro-tech. We have to look at the entire AI-mediated epistemic configuration.
Which sounds very academic.
It does, yeah. But it just means the complete ecosystem of how a society creates knowledge, how it makes its decisions, and how it wields its power using AI.
So it's bigger than just the software.
Way bigger. We are moving so far beyond the standard debate of like whether a specific algorithm is biased or if artificial general intelligence is going to take our jobs in a decade.
Right.
This is really about the plumbing of reality. It's about who has the authority to define what is true, who is deemed risky, and who actually gets a voice right now today.
And to understand where that authority currently sits, the paper draws this really hard, very necessary line between two distinct concepts.
Yes, system intelligence and civilizational
Right,
intelligence.
which we constantly mix up, I think. I mean, we see a large language model, right? You know, a flawless Python script in 2 seconds.
Or a diagnostic AI spots a tumor that three human doctors completely missed.
Exactly. And we see that, and we just assume, well, because the system is incredibly smart at that specific task, it must be equipped to make broader societal choices.
And that conflation right there is the root of the whole crisis. Let's break them down.
Please.
System intelligence is bounded. It airs the capacity of a machine to, optimize, predict, retrieve, or classify data within a heavily specified objective.
So, like catching an anomaly in a giant financial data set.
Yes. Or predicting the folding structure of a complex protein, or even generating a really persuasive paragraph of text. Those are all acts of system intelligence.
And the performance is amazing.
It is breathtaking, but it is fundamentally closed. The objective is handed to the machine, and the machine just executes it.
Right. It doesn't question the objective. Whereas civilizational intelligence is, it's the distributed, institutionally organized capacity of a society to actually examine those objectives themselves.
Exactly. It's the messy part.
Yeah, the very human, friction-heavy process of looking around and asking, wait, who is being excluded by this objective?
Right. It is the ability to weigh moral burdens, to assign legal responsibility when things go sideways, to repair injuries, and to, legitimately revise the actual rules of society.
Which a machine obviously can't do.
No, because civilizational intelligence requires standing. It requires legitimate, recognized judgment and the capacity for institutional self-correction.
Right.
An AI system can support that process, sure. It can crunch the data required for a society to make an informed choice, but it cannot self-authorize.
Because it has no skin in the game.
Exactly. It doesn't suffer the consequences of a bad policy. You can't put an algorithm in jail, and you can't vote it out of office.
You know, this really feels like using a navigation app in a car.
Okay, yeah, how so?
Well, the app possesses incredible system intelligence. It will calculate the absolute fastest route. It'll avoid a traffic jam on the interstate, calculate all your toll costs, and get you to the exact GPS coordinates you typed in.
Flawlessly.
Flawlessly. But civilizational intelligence is the driver. The driver is the one who decides why they are going to that destination in the first place, whether the trip is, you know, morally or economically justified, and who is allowed in the car for the ride.
That's a great analogy. The app optimizes the route, but it has absolutely zero capacity to self-authorize the journey.
Oh, right. But let me push back on that a bit. If the AI system intelligence is vastly superior, like, if it knows the roads perfectly, shouldn't we just let it pick the destination? I mean, maybe it knows a better place for us to go.
It's tempting to think that way. But the author points out that superior computational performance might warrant reliance within a bounded function, like we should absolutely use the AI to map the traffic.
Right.
But that computational superiority does not independently confer authority over collective ends. I mean, think about a highly accurate recidivism predictor used in a courtroom. It might be incredible at its specific mathematical task of calculating statistical reoffense rates based on historical data, but it does not have the moral or political standing to define the legal purpose of punishment in a society.
Because that's a philosophical question.
Exactly. Is the purpose of our justice system rehabilitation? Is it retribution? Is it deterrence?
A predictive algorithm can't answer those.
You can't. But if we let its risk scores blindly dictate sentencing, we have accidentally allowed the algorithm to answer those questions for us. Accuracy does not equal legitimacy.
Yeah. Knowing better doesn't establish a right to rule. And if you're listening to this, just think about your own workplace. How often is a metric, which is just a pure expression of system intelligence, mistaken for the actual goal of the company?
Oh, all the time.
Right. Like, a hospital might introduce an algorithm to optimize bed turnover rates. The system intelligence does its job flawlessly, getting patients in and out faster.
But the civilizational intelligence of the hospital, its core mission to heal the sick, gets hollowed out.
Exactly. Because the metric became the master. The doctors end up serving the algorithm's objective, not the hospital's foundational purpose.
And when a society scales that dynamic, it walks straight into what the paper calls the augmentation sovereignty dilemma.
Okay, what is that?
Well, AI dramatically increases our capability to process information. That is the augmentation part. But as we integrate these systems deeper into our workflows, a silent transfer of practical authority occurs.
So we slowly give up control.
Yes. We move along a spectrum. We go from using AI as a tool to relying on it as an intermediary to finally submitting to it as infrastructure.
Let's trace that spectrum, because I know it doesn't happen overnight.
It definitely doesn't.
So as a tool, AI is entirely optional. It is visible and it's a task bounded. Like, I use a translation app to read a menu in a foreign country. If it gives me a weird translation, I just put my phone away and point at the pastry I want.
Exactly. You haven't lost any autonomy there.
Right. But then it evolves into an intermediary.
Yes. Here, it begins to actively shape your attention. It retrieves, it ranks, it summarizes information for you.
Like an AI assistant reading my morning emails.
Right. It gives you a 3-bullet-point summary of your inbox. You are still ostensibly in charge, but the AI is now defining your informational reality. It's deciding which email was important and which was noise.
And then we hit the final stage, which the paper calls crossing the infrastructure threshold.
This is the danger zone.
Yeah, a system crosses this line when it hits three very specific criteria. First is criticality.
Meaning the function becomes absolutely essential to basic rights, public services, or collective memory. You literally can't run the power grid or process well for applications without it.
Second is durable dependency.
This is where institutions actually reorganize their internal structures around the AI.
Like they fire the junior analysts.
Yep. They change their data formatting just to feed the machine. They alter their legal compliance standards to match the AI's output. The whole organization bends to the software.
And the third criterion is substitution difficulty. It becomes incredibly hard or prohibitively expensive or just technically impossible to switch providers or exit the system entirely.
Right. When a system hits all three of those, criticality, dependency, and substitution difficulty, it is no longer just software. It adds the epistemic infrastructure of the institution.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Because this is where the sovereignty dilemma bites, right?
Yes.
And just to clarify, sovereignty in this context isn't some sci-fi scenario of robots taking over the government.
No, no. It means institutional dependency.
Right. So we were talking about a boiling frog situation here.
Hmm.
We accept the tool because it makes our lives easier, it augments us. But at what point does it cross from just being helpful infrastructure to actual epistemic sovereignty?
Well, crossing the infrastructure threshold doesn't automatically mean a loss of sovereignty. Shared digital infrastructure can be immensely beneficial. It creates interoperability, it lowers costs, it allows scientific data to be shared globally.
So infrastructure isn't inherently evil.
Not at all. Sovereignty is only lost when that infrastructure exposure is combined with authority spillover.
Authority spillover. Meaning the moment the technical performance of the AI starts defining the actual purposes and consequences of the institution.
Exactly. It is when the AI's definition of fraud or risk or value becomes the only definition the institution recognizes. And that is combined with a total loss of contestability.
I can't argue with it anymore.
Right. You can no longer credibly challenge the system, and the institution has dismantled all the alternative human pathways that could have processed your challenge. You become entirely captive to the machine's epistemology.
Wow. And to defend against this, the paper demands we stop obsessing over the model or the algorithm in isolation.
Yes. Governing a language model by itself is like trying to govern traffic by staring at a single spark plug.
That's a great way to put it. We have to look at the whole vehicle, the roads, the fuel supply, the laws.
Which the paper calls the AI-mediated epistemic configuration.
Right. It is the full stack. It's not just the algorithm. It's the underlying data, the raw compute power, the massive cloud servers, the technical standards, the deploying tech giants, the public institutions buying the software, and most importantly, the affected persons whose lives are altered by it.
And cutting across that entire stack is this really crucial concept of the epistemic commons.
Because knowledge isn't naturally self-governing.
Exactly. The author leans heavily on traditional knowledge commons scholarship here.
Yeah.
Whether you're talking about a physical pasture, a freshwater aquifer, or the collective knowledge of humanity's shared resources require rules.
Right. You can't just dump all human data into a massive digital pool and expect it to manage itself fairly.
It requires governance.
We're all familiar with the tragedy of the commons in environmental terms, right? Like overgrazing a shared pasture until the soil dies, or factories dumping chemicals into a public river because no single entity owns the water. Dr. Suhaili is applying this directly to knowledge. He's arguing that training a massive AI model on the open internet without reciprocal governance is the exact same extractive behavior as clear-cutting a public forest.
It is. And that leads to a vital contrast the paper draws regarding how we manage data. For the past two decades, the tech industry and academia have championed the FAIR principles for data management.
FAIR stands for findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable.
Yes.
Which sounds fantastic on the surface. I mean, if you are a scientist trying to cure a disease, you want the genomic data of the virus to be findable, accessible, interoperable with your software, and reusable by other labs.
And FAIR principles are phenomenal for machine-assisted discovery and accelerating scientific velocity. But as the paper points out, FAIR principles are morally hollow.
Wow, morally hollow.
Yeah, because they do not inherently address power, equity, or justice. They simply make data easy to extract and process. So the paper contrasts FAIR with the CARE principles.
The CARE principles, where do those come from?
They emerged from indigenous data sovereignty movements. CARE stands for collective benefit, authority to control, responsibility, and ethics.
This feels like a massive paradigm shift because the tech industry has operated on this assumption that open source and open data are universally, unequivocally good things.
Right, but openness without governance is just extraction.
Yes. Think about it like leaving the front door of your house wide open. Yes, it is highly accessible.
Very fair.
Right. But someone could just walk in, take your family's secret recipes, mass produce them, and give you zero credit or profit.
Exactly. If a marginalized community's traditional agricultural knowledge or their linguistic heritage is made perfectly fair, findable, and accessible, it just means a multinational tech company can easily scrape it.
They train a proprietary model on it?
Yep. Patent a derivative product and sell it back to the world, while the community that generated the knowledge receives zero collective benefit and has absolutely no authority to control how it was used.
And the CARE principles demand that knowledge requires collective political authority and consent.
Yes. It's not enough to just hold a generic stakeholder consultation where a tech company listens to community concerns for an hour and then does whatever it wants anyway. CARE recognizes actual political and cultural jurisdiction over data.
The paper highlights something called local contexts as an example of this, right?
Yeah, specifically their traditional knowledge labels. It's a bounded probe into how this works in practice. These labels allow communities to embed their own governance protocols and usage restrictions directly into the digital metadata of their cultural heritage.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Right. The data might be visible, but the machine is legally and technically constrained from extracting it without honoring the embedded protocol.
So applying this to the current AI landscape is just staggering. We are watching frontier AI companies scrape the entirety of the open internet. Every book, every forum post, every piece of digital art, every piece of open source code ever written.
It is epistemic extraction on a global scale.
Under the lens of the epistemic commons, this is the largest enclosure of shared wealth in human history. They are extracting the entire global commons of human thought, running it through their private server farms, stripping it of its original context, and then charging us a monthly subscription fee to access a synthesized version of our own collective intelligence.
And this inevitably leads to profound conflicts, because there will be times when a specific community's desire for authority over their data conflicts with a broader public interest, say, in medical research or climate modeling.
Right. It's not always black and white.
Exactly. But the paper argues that a defensible society must have a process to adjudicate that conflict. We must ask if the proposed extraction is strictly necessary, if it is proportionate, and who actually captures the material benefit.
The epistemic commons has to be treated as a governed, delicate ecology, not a free-for-all warehouse waiting to be looted. Well, if the extraction of the data requires such rigorous governance, the human decisions generated by that data require an even higher level of scrutiny, which moves us into a concept that I found completely paradigm-shattering.
The illusion of the human in the loop?
Yes. The illusion of the human in the loop and the mechanics of authority laundering.
This is where the paper is most deeply critical of our current regulatory frameworks. The entire Western approach to AI safety right now rests on the capability-authority separation principle we discussed earlier.
Meaning superior computational performance does not confer legitimate authority over collective ends.
Right. And because of that, the paper insists on the principle of responsibility non-transfer.
Meaning you can delegate tasks to AI, but a public institution cannot extinguish its answerability. You can't just say, the system decided.
You can outsource the math, but you cannot outsource the responsibility.
Yet every day, institutions try to do exactly that.
They do, and their primary shield is the human in the loop.
Right. The narrative is that as long as there's a human being sitting at a desk somewhere, looking at a screen, and physically clicking a button that says approve or deny, based on the AI's recommendation, the system is safely under human control.
And the author systematically dismantles this. In most institutional settings, that human in the loop is merely engaged in responsibility theater.
Responsibility theater.
Yes. Or worse, they are positioned as a moral crumple zone.
A moral crumple zone. I mean, think about that. The front of a car is designed to crush on impact to absorb the kinetic energy and protect the passengers in the cabin.
Exactly.
In an institutional context, the frontline worker is the crumple zone, protecting the executives and the software developers.
Consider a junior nurse using a highly complex diagnostic AI, or an Amazon warehouse worker being directed by a logistical algorithm. The system is designed by distant engineers to optimize a specific metric. The frontline worker is told they have the final say.
But do they really?
No, because if they disagree with the AI, they have to spend 30 minutes filling out a justification form they don't have time for. They get flagged by management for slowing down the queue, and they don't even have access to the underlying training data to explain why they think the AI is wrong.
So they just start clicking approve.
Right. It's just called automation bias. And when the AI inevitably makes a catastrophic error, a patient dies, or a worker is injured, the institution doesn't blame the algorithm or the executives who bought it.
They blame the human in the loop.
Yes. They say, the nurse had the final authority to override the system and failed to do so. The human absorbs the legal and moral impact of the failure, insulating the institution.
That is so dark.
The paper argues that true human control is not just having a finger on a mouse button. Real control requires epistemic capacity, sufficient cognitive space and time to evaluate the output, actual decisional authority without fear of algorithmic retaliation, and the practical immediate power to stop or reverse the system.
Without all those, the human is just a liability sponge.
Well put. And this feeds directly into the concept of institutional warrant laundering.
Which is such an insidious administrative trick.
It really is. Imagine a bank setting up an AI to evaluate loan applications. The bank executives make a highly subjective, normative policy choice. They decide they want to drastically reduce their risk exposure, even if it means denying loans to creditworthy people from marginalized neighborhoods.
Which is a political and business choice.
Yes, but they bake that subjective risk tolerance into the mathematical threshold of the AI model.
And when the applicant asks why they were denied, the bank doesn't say, "Our executives made a subjective choice to redline your demographic."
No, they point to the algorithm. They say, "The AI evaluated the objective data and determined you are a high risk."
Wow.
The fluency, the complexity, and the mathematical scale of the AI conceal the normative choice. The institution takes its subjective policy, washes it through the black box of the machine, and presents the output to the public as pure, objective, technical evidence.
That is authority laundering. But wait, let me push back and challenge this from a purely utilitarian perspective.
Sure.
If we concede that an AI model trained on billions of data points is statistically vastly superior at spotting a tumor on an MRI or, you know, predicting the structural failure of a bridge, aren't we just indulging human ego by demanding that a flawed, biased, tired human always has the final say? Won't humans just mess up the optimal results?
It's a strong utilitarian argument, but it misses the critical distinction between episodic accuracy and institutional legitimacy.
Okay, unpack that.
The paper does not argue that humans should veto the AI on a case-by-case basis out of sheer pride. The AI will often be more accurate in bounded tasks. We know this.
Right.
Their issue is institutional control. It's about society maintaining the capacity to set the boundaries of the system, to actively audit the results for drift, to define the human consequences of the outputs, and to ensure there is a functional fallback mechanism.
Ah, because if we let the muscle memory of how to run the hospital or the power grid atrophy because the AI is so good, what happens when the AI is poisoned by bad data or the servers go down?
Exactly. Meaningful control isn't about second-guessing every single calculation. It's about retaining the structural power to shut the system down or redesign it if it begins serving a misaligned objective.
It's about not losing the epistemic independence required to even know if the machine is failing.
Right.
To truly grasp the stakes of losing that institutional control, we don't even have to look to the future. We can look at a real-world disaster from the recent past.
Yeah.
The paper anchors its argument about administrative injury in this massive case study, the Australian robo-debt disaster.
Yes. To contextualize robo-debt, we first have to look at what Dr. Sakili calls institutional recognition power.
Okay.
Every large institution wields the power to categorize people. They use algorithms to define who is a flight risk, who is eligible for disability benefits, who is a promising job candidate, and who is a fraudster. And this classification is never just a neutral, descriptive act. It is a performative act that organizes a person's visibility to the state and determines the material consequences they will face.
And to constrain this immense power, the paper introduces the person model principle.
Which is vital.
Yeah, this principle argues that a digital model of a person, like their data double, their risk score, their statistical profile, must never become the exact, exhaustive measure of the actual human being.
Because a probabilistic classification cannot determine a person's inherent moral worth, their civic standing, or their fundamental rights.
The map is not the territory. Prediction is not destiny.
Exactly. And robo-debt was a catastrophic violation of the person model principle.
For those who might be unfamiliar, robo-debt was an automated debt recovery program deployed by the Australian government. The goal was to identify welfare recipients who had been overpaid and automatically claw back the money.
And the technical mechanism they used was called income averaging. It is crucial to understand how absurd this logic actually was.
Yeah, please explain it.
The government took a person's annual income data from the tax office and mathematically averaged it evenly across the entire year, dividing it into fortnightly or two-week chunks.
Okay.
They then compared those mathematical averages against the income the person had actually reported to the welfare agency during specific fortnights when they claimed benefits.
The flaw is so obvious the moment you think about how precarious labor works.
Right.
If you are unemployed for 6 months and claim welfare, and then you get a really high-paying temporary contract for the next 6 months, your annual income might look substantial.
Yes.
But if a machine takes that annual total and averages it across all 12 months, it creates the mathematical illusion that you are earning a steady paycheck during the exact weeks you are claiming welfare.
The algorithm hallucinated income that didn't exist in reality. It's scaled an inherently flawed and ultimately unlawful evidentiary premise.
And the scale of the deployment was staggering. We're talking approximately $1.763 billion in asserted debts against roughly 433,000 people.
But the defining horror of robo-debt was not just the mathematical miscalculation. It was the governance structure built around the calculation.
Right.
The government utilized the automation to shift the entire burden of proof onto the most vulnerable citizens. Historically, if the state accused you of welfare fraud, the state had to investigate and prove it.
Under robo-debt, the machine issued the accusation automatically, and the citizen had to prove their innocence.
Yes. You had to dig up 7-year-old payslips from businesses that might have gone bankrupt just to prove the algorithm's average was wrong.
This brings us to a critical concept in the paper, dual error governance.
Yes.
Because in any classification system, you are going to have errors. You have false negatives, people who were overpaid but the machine missed them. And you have false positives, people who did nothing wrong but the machine flags them as debtors.
Right. And the central question of AI governance is not how do we eliminate all errors? The real question is, when a system makes an error, who bears the burden?
And in robo-debt, the state deliberately configured the system so that the entirety of the friction, the uncertainty, and the material harm of a false positive fell onto the citizens with the least power.
The government reaped the efficiency gains, and the citizens absorbed the systemic trauma. People had their wages garnished, their mental health destroyed, and there were tragic reports of suicides linked to the crushing despair of fighting a faceless automated system.
But how did this bypass human review? I mean, weren't there appeals? When 433,000 people are suddenly hit with massive false debts, they don't just suffer in silence. Why didn't the feedback loop trigger a shutdown?
This is perhaps the most chilling aspect of the case study. It reveals how institutions actively neutralize feedback. There were first-tier review processes. Citizens could appeal, and many did.
Yeah.
If a citizen fought hard enough, produced all the paperwork, and endured the grueling process, the agency would often quietly wipe their individual debt. But, and this is the key, that successful individual challenge never cascaded upward to change the governing rule of the algorithm itself.
The system lacked what the paper calls constitutional reflexivity.
Exactly. Constitutional reflexivity is the capacity for bottom-up evidence of failure to penetrate the deepest levels of the institution and force a structural redesign.
Not just an output correction.
Right. In robo-debt, the institution treated the appeals merely as individual customer service complaints, rather than treating them as glaring diagnostic evidence that the core infrastructure was broken.
They neutralized the feedback loop.
They kept the broken machine running because it was generating revenue and political capital, insulating the core logic from the very people it was harming. An AI deployed without constitutional reflexivity is not an administrative tool. It is an instrument of structural violence.
Man. Ask yourself, if you're listening to this, how many automated systems categorize you daily? Credit scores, resume filters, insurance premiums. And think about how hard it is to argue with an algorithm.
It's nearly impossible for an individual.
RoboDebt shows how AI can unfairly penalize individuals. But what happens when AI starts synthesizing our collective political thought?
That shifts us from the realm of categorization to the realm of synthesis.
Generative AI models, the language models we interact with daily.
Yes. They are phenomenal engines of compression. They can ingest 10,000 pages of town hall transcripts, municipal codes, and public comments, and synthesize them into a highly readable 2-page brief.
But synthesis is never a neutral act of translation. It requires provenance, visible dissent, alternative interpretations. To summarize is to choose what to highlight, what to completely omit, how to frame the competing categories.
The paper makes a very sharp distinction here between deliberative augmentation and deliberative substitution.
Okay, what's the difference?
Deliberative augmentation is incredibly healthy for a democracy. This is when AI is used to map out complex arguments, to translate dense legislative jargon into plain language so citizens can actually understand what is being voted on. The AI is a scaffolding for human thought.
Deliberative substitution.
That is when the AI begins to constitute the public will itself. It is when the machine invisibly persuades users, smooths over fundamental disagreements, erases the nuance of minority opinions, and manufactures a false, frictionless sense of agreement.
To illustrate this danger, the author dissects a fascinating 2024 experiment conducted by DeepMind.
The Habermas machine.
Yes, named after Jürgen Habermas, the philosopher famous for his theories on the public sphere and communicative rationality.
Right. The Habermas machine was an AI designed to mediate small group deliberations. It would listen to participants debating a contentious topic and then iteratively generate common ground statements attempting to capture the group's shared views.
And according to the study, it was highly effective. I mean, participants frequently preferred the AI-generated consensus statements over the statements drafted by human mediators.
It was faster, it was articulate, and it found the mathematical middle ground efficiently.
That sounds like a massive victory for civic technology.
It is a victory for efficiency, certainly. But the author issues a stark warning. Finding a statistical consensus is fundamentally different from democratic authorization.
Right.
There is a profound risk here of generating what the paper calls synthetic consensus, when the AI smooths over all the rough edges to produce a statement that everyone can technically agree with. It often does so by quietly deleting the core principled demands of the minority voices.
It sounds like having an incredibly smooth-talking, highly charismatic mediator who rewrites a treaty so beautifully that everyone signs it, but no one realizes their core demands are quietly deleted.
The fluency is the trap. Hmm. What's fascinating here is that the Habermas machine study itself noted that the AI tended to avoid minority viewpoints because they mathematically lower the overall group approval score.
Because it's optimizing for agreement.
Yeah, exactly. In a democracy, human friction is valuable. Holding out as a minority voice forces the majority to actually confront, debate, and justify their position. If an AI just mathematically averages the sentiments, the minority doesn't get heard. They just get blended into the statistical noise.
Wow.
Furthermore, studies cited in the paper demonstrate that language models can actively shift user attitudes on political issues invisibly. The interface is so helpful and the text is so authoritative that users do not realize their own epistemological boundaries are being redrawn.
The paper extrapolates this to an even grander scale, discussing mnemonic sovereignty.
Yes.
If we project this forward 5 or 10 years, institutions will increasingly rely on AI to summarize their own archives, to interpret historical precedents, and to maintain their institutional memory.
Right.
If an LLM becomes the primary lens through which we view our past, do we risk forgetting everything that the AI deems unimportant or outside the consensus?
Historians will tell you that the truth is often found in the marginalia, the weird outlier documents in the archives. If the AI deletes the marginalia because it is statistically insignificant, the AI assumes mnemonic sovereignty. It dictates what we remember.
Because AI can so easily shape our reality and our consensus, we absolutely must have alternative systems to challenge it. We cannot rely on a single monolithic epistemic engine.
Which brings us to the necessity of epistemic independence and countercapacity.
Public countercapacity. What is that exactly?
It amends the tangible ability of public institutions, academic researchers, and civic watchdogs to independently test, audit, and evaluate the claims made by the frontier AI companies. We cannot simply take a tech giant's word that their new model is safe and unbiased.
But the immediate pushback from a free market perspective is that we already have countercapacity through market competition. We don't just have one AI. We have a dozen major corporate actors.
Right.
Doesn't that diversity provide the plurality we need?
The paper anticipates this argument and makes a crucial distinction between having multiple brands and having what it calls usable plurality.
Usable plurality.
Having 10 different corporate logos on your screen is not true plurality if all 10 of those companies are relying on the exact same upstream training data, running on the same concentrated supply of advanced silicon chips, and hosted on the same 3 hyperscale cloud networks.
Oh, right.
If the foundational architecture and the supply chain are identical, the systems will likely exhibit correlated errors and identical blind spots. Real usable plurality requires diversity at the infrastructural layer to avoid a single point of epistemic failure.
Dr. Saley points to the AlphaFold database as a blueprint for what governed scientific augmentation could look like, right?
AlphaFold is a strong, positive case study. It is a massive database containing the predicted structures of over 240 million proteins. But importantly, it is hosted publicly. The data is openly licensed. Scientists worldwide can download the predictions and experimentally contest them.
It is a massive epistemic public good.
However, even with AlphaFold, The paper identifies a lingering vulnerability regarding upstream dependency. The outputs are public, yes, but the massive computational power required to regenerate that database from scratch, estimated at roughly 17 million GPU hours, remains entirely concentrated in the hands of private corporations.
So the public has access to the fruit, but they do not own the orchard, and they cannot afford the water required to grow a new one.
Beautifully put. And this highlights the gulf between formal autonomy and epistemic independence. The paper explores this by critiquing emerging governance frameworks like the EU AI Act and the UN Scientific Panel on AI.
The EU AI Act is widely touted as the gold standard for global AI regulation right now.
It has a robust formal architecture. But as the author notes from the vantage point of late 2026, its practical implementation remains unproven. If a regulatory body does not possess the technical capacity and the compute power to actually interrogate a frontier model at the algorithmic level, the regulation is purely administrative.
Same with the UN panel.
Right. A UN scientific panel can have global boundary authority. But if they have to rely on a tech giant's own internal safety reports, because the UN lacks compulsory power, and the supercomputers to run the tests themselves, they are not epistemically independent.
So what does this all mean? Are government supercomputers the answer, like NARR in the U.S. or the EuroHPC supercomputers in Europe? Can we just build public AI to keep the private labs in check?
Public ownership is a powerful lever, but it's not a magic bullet.
Why not?
Because if a government supercomputer still relies on the exact same concentrated, fragile global supply chains for advanced chips and clouds, the dependency hasn't been eliminated, it has just shifted.
Plus, public AI can easily be weaponized for mass state surveillance.
Exactly. True countercapacity requires the power to audit, the ability to switch providers, and the resilience to maintain operational continuity if a dominant AI system suddenly goes offline.
Speaking of clouds and supercomputers, there is a massive blind spot in how we govern these systems. We need to strip away the metaphor of the cloud entirely and look at the physical dirt, water, and sweat that builds AI.
We have to examine the material political economy of AI.
Right, because the cloud implies something light, natural, and infinite. But AI is a heavy, extractive industrial operation.
It is factories, mines, cables, and power plants. Material accountability asks a very grounded distributional question. Who is receiving the cognitive benefit of the AI, and who is bearing the local grid, land, water, and labor burdens?
The statistics cited in the paper are just staggering. Looking at International Energy Agency data for 2024, data centers consumed roughly 415 terawatt hours of electricity.
That was 1.5% of the total global electricity demand.
And it is projected to hit near 950 terawatt hours by 2030. And the water footprint. AI models run extremely hot. U.S. data centers alone directly consume 66 billion liters of water in 2023.
And that is merely the operational footprint. The paper highlights the extreme fragility and concentration of the physical supply chain. The advanced lithography machines are essentially a monopoly. The foundries manufacturing the silicon, like TSMC, are highly concentrated, and the hyperscale clouds are dominated by just a few companies.
This concentration creates massive geopolitical bottlenecks, but it also creates hyperlocal environmental devastation.
Right. A data center can drain the municipal water supply of an entire community just to cool the GPUs running queries for people thousands of miles away.
And the extraction isn't just ecological. It is intensely human. The paper brings up the ghost labor that powers this illusion of automated intelligence.
Yes, specifically a study of microtask workers in Kenya. These are the human beings paid pennies to manually look at thousands of images or read toxic text prompts and label them so the AI can learn.
The AI industry promotes a narrative of a frictionless, magical, automated future. But that magic is subsidized by a vast, hidden underclass of underpaid data annotators facing unpaid rejections. The AI is learning from their cognitive labor, but the wealth generated flows entirely to the global north.
But tech companies have a defense for this.
Right. They say AI will optimize the smart grid, discover new materials to fight climate change. Isn't a temporary energy spike worth the long-term environmental salvation AI might bring?
The paper eviscerates that defense using the lens of distributional justice. Promises of speculative future efficiency do not negate present-day extraction and local harm.
You can't just buy carbon credits and claim your net zero if you're draining a local river.
Exactly. A global average of energy efficiency conceals the local community whose water supply was drained without their consent.
When we look at all these layers, from the physical water to the digital rules to the democratic impacts, how do we actually evaluate and fix a broken system?
Dr. Seeley proposes the AI Epistemic Commons Constitutional Matrix. It evaluates an AI configuration across 12 distinct dimensions.
Things like purpose, authority, resource governance, epistemic warrant.
Plurality, recognition, agency, responsibility, remedy, countercapacity, material distribution, and reflexivity.
That is a lot. But the core takeaway is that this matrix prevents us from using a single ethics score.
Precisely. You can't balance out the fact that a system unlawfully jails people by pointing out that it is highly energy efficient. Some failures are non-compensable.
It's like a restaurant poisoning you, and their apology is, well, we fired the chef and updated the recipe. That's great for the next customer, but you still need your stomach pumped and your hospital bill paid.
Exactly. And if the restaurant's fundamental business model relies on serving rotten food quickly, firing one chef does nothing. Constitutional reflexivity means having the power to shut the restaurant down.
Which brings us to algorithmic repair. Repair is not just updating the model to fix a bug, right? A rollback isn't enough.
No. True repair requires five pillars. Restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, satisfaction, which means public apologies and truth-telling, and guarantees of non-repetition.
A guarantee of non-repetition means actually changing the underlying laws and rules. Constitutional reflexivity means evidence of failure must be able to reach the deepest institutional level and trigger a redesign of the rules, not just an output correction.
If an institution cannot meaningfully absorb evidence of its own AI-driven failures and restructure its core rules in response, it has lost its civilizational intelligence.
Let's wrap this up, summarizing the core thesis here. Civilizational intelligence doesn't mean humans must always outcalculate machines.
Who won't?
Right. It means the institutions that wield AI must remain answerable, corrigible, and open to revision. AI must be a participant in the epistemic commons, never its sovereign. Now, for you listening, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought that builds on all of this. If AI becomes the ultimate frictionless synthesizer of all human knowledge, always giving us the perfectly smoothed out consensus answer, do we risk losing the cognitive friction that actually generates new ideas?
That's a profound question.
Because creativity often comes from misunderstanding, from frustration, from digging through the messy archives yourself. In a future where AI thinks for us perfectly, will human genius rely entirely on those who choose to unplug and unlearn?
Something to really think about.
Thank you for taking this deep dive with us. Keep questioning the tools you use every day.